your phone for the first?
Yes. Now, first of all, I have a few questions which are about your personal background. We talked about that last time, but there are a few things I wanted to clear up, and that is, which year were you born in?
1931.
And that was in Birmingham, or?
No, London.
Whereabouts in London?
Really, I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know. You've asked me a question, I don't know. I know I was born in London.
Where did you grow up in London?
Ipswich. Didn't grow up in London. My parents moved from London to Ipswich. And I was brought up just on the outskirts of Ipswich, a place called Nacton.
Okay. And what was the family background? What did your father do?
My father was a painter and decorator. And my mother was, she was in service before she married. That's, she looked after an old colonel, right? Indian Army colonel. Cooking, cleaning and what have you for him. In general service until she married my father, and then she didn't work. I mean, she became a housewife, and that was it.
Was your father employed through the 30s, do you know?
Oh yes, he was never out of work, to my knowledge. In fact, I was one of the fortunate ones. I always had pennies when others had nothing. But he was called up during the emergency of 1939. What else do you want to know?
No, that's...
Okay, yes, okay. Well, he was called up, he went to the army in 1939.
Did he ever work self-employed?
No, never self-employed. He always worked for a sort of boss. Now, who his bosses were, I've no idea. I mean, I wasn't interested at that time.
No. Was there any politics at home, one sort or another? What was the political...
Not my father, but my grandfather was very political. He used to carry on correspondence all over the country with various people on politics. I mean, he was a very political man, and he had leanings very strongly to the left. And he was very clever. But, I mean, he was an intelligent man without a tremendous amount of schooling. He was born in 1875, my grandfather, and I had a lot to do with my grandfather. He and I were, that way I was the apple of his eye. And I spent more time with my grandfather, right, during the war years than I spent with my father. My father was away all the time. I mean, that's it. But my grandfather was there, and I sort of grew up muchly under his influence in my formative years, from sort of 8, I think it was, to 14, something like that. My father was away at the wars. Right. I mean, he came home occasionally, and after the war, the family, they divorced. I mean, the war sort of mixed them up. But so I was much under the influence of my grandfather.
And you owe sort of your early political education
to my grandfather.
Yes,
to much to my grandfather. Yes, I used to go to political meetings with him. He used to go to war meetings. He'd go to sort of Tory meetings. Go to Labour meetings, but he was a Labour man through and through. And he was a clever man. He had a hard life. You know, I mean, in 1875, our family originated in sort of Upward Eye, around in Southwark. You know the place at all?
No.
No, well, that's where we originated. And he was a member, he was one of about 12 or 13, he had 12 kids himself, so I'll take it that my memory serves me right, about 12 or 13. His parents married twice, but his mother had about 12, 13 kids, some of them died, and his experience, early experience life was very tough, which made him lean towards the left, obviously. I mean, they hadn't got anything, they were farmers, they lived off the land, there was no sort of industry, it was all agrarian.
Yes.
And he left school when he was 10. He always used to tell me, the teacher said to him one day, William, William, come out here, he said, you're that clever, he said, but I can't teach you anything else. Whether that was said in jest, or whether it was said in anger, or whether it was said meaningfully. Grandfather said I did. He said I went out and I taught the class, reading, writing, arithmetic. He said I could do it as well as the teacher. But when he was gone, about 10 and a half, 11, his parents needed him to earn money. And he had a job, a penny a day. And it was the fall of the year, and they were harvesting. And he used to walk 6 miles in the morning and 6 miles at night. And he used to carry the beer for the men in the fields. To carry the beer, brew the tea, do whatever they wanted. Just get a penny a day for it. And got a penny a day. Oh, wow. He saw his sister die of consumption. And then, at that time, the country had no welfare state. So it was sort of the poor law. I think that was the poor law, I'm not too sure.
Yes.
Ground there. The poor laws existed then.
Oh, yes.
And the parish council decided who got what. And I mean, he saw his sister die, and he saw her husband. The husband died first of consumption when she went to the poor, you know, the board where they got.
Yes, the board.
She had a child, and he never tired of telling me that, because that really made him better. He loved his sister. And she'd had a child, and she said, oh, pay some money, and I think I said, God, I think it was. She got to pay the rent, buy the food, clothe herself, look after her dying husband, and I said, you can have 2 shillings, 6p, which was a sizable amount of money, but I cut it down to 2 shillings because I said, you charge the food off the breast, therefore you don't need money for that. Then I cut it again, I cut it down to 1 and 6p because they said, we can supply flour. There was a lot of flour or something, I don't know, so that's supply flour.
Yeah.
That sort of yarn.
Yes,
that's what he did. So then he eventually left there and he travelled all around Britain, building railroads, building docks, building roads. And eventually he married and settled down at Felixstowe. And I've seen the cottage, it's gone now, but he settled in a little cottage over the old Ooling pub, right on the mouth of the River Orwell and the River Star. And he had 12 kids. And so his life was sort of hard.
Yes.
Hard.
Yes.
Thanks, love. What do I have?
I don't know how much it is. Will you see the gaffer when you're in the
house? Okay, yes. Thank you, love. Thank you. And, so his life was hard. But fair, I mean, he was quite a fair man, you know, and he was open to arguments either side of the board. I mean, he was over fond of saying if he had his way with the Tory buggers, he'd line them all up, steamroll them into a ditch. I mean, it was quite well. He couldn't see at some times in his sort of life, he couldn't see any good in them at all. But he got this sort of split personality. He was an avid admirer of Churchill. And prior to the war, I mean, he was on about Churchill's warning this country and nobody's doing anything about it, and Churchill was warning the country, and he was in agreement with Churchill. He'd been through the First World War, he'd been injured, and he was most concerned, and Churchill was a hero of his. In fact, when Churchill died, I think it had a lot to do with my grandfather's death. He died when he was 90, and Churchill died, and he said to me, it upset him. You know, he said, there's another one of my contemporaries.
Yes. Exactly. Yes.
You know, I mean, it was a sort of link.
Mm.
And he died, and that. But that's sort of, so yeah, you know, I was under that sort of influence.
Did you join the Labour Party when you were at school or after school?
Mm. Oh, yes, I did. And I was a member of the Labour Party until the winter of discontent, when the Labour Party completely lost control of the country and the trade unions took over, and although I am a socialist, there was no way I could vote for people who would allow that to happen in this country. No way. And so I withheld my vote, I dropped out of the Labour Party, told them why. Because until they do something to rectify that situation, which I still haven't done, like, there's no way you can vote for people like that to run a country. And I'd rather see Maggie Thatcher run the country, even though I disagreed with her base policies. At least she makes a decision.
Yeah.
She doesn't. Yeah. And so, although I don't agree with her policies, I do agree with her decision making.
And you haven't joined the Tories as part of the
party? No, I couldn't join the Tories, for God's sake. It's against everything that I know and want. No way would I join the Tories. They have not got the right idea on how to run the country. They've got the right idea on how to organise, brilliant organisers in my opinion. And I mean, they're not wicked. I mean, they are decent people. And they do things that they see as correct. And I just don't happen to see them as correct. I believe in the welfare state, they don't.
Yes, yes.
I believe that we should be more responsible to the third world, they don't. Some of the things I believe in are absolute rubbish. Nonetheless, I believe in them. And those are not rubbish that I've mentioned. Right? I happen to believe in them. And I happen to believe also that industry is not there for shareholders and managers to make huge profits in. Although that's essentially the business going. But it is there as a servant to the community. You know, without people, they won't make a profit. So I think people should have a say in industry. And I'm not at all happy at the way things are going at the moment. With trade union legislation drifting through as it is, and it's needed. I mean, I believe that we should have votes. Although I'm not a member of trade union.
No.
But I mean, I think the members should vote for who the hell they're going to have running their trade union. I think trade unions should be responsible for their actions. They should be responsible for their actions to the country. And not necessarily responsible in a direct sense to the country, but in an indirect way to the country, and directly to their members who work in factories. And where they've fallen short of the mark is that they're not being involved in the decision making in the boardrooms, which they should be. They had the opportunity and they threw it out. They should be involved in these, because with this legislation coming in, it's lopsided. They are telling the trade unions, you've got to do these things, and like you said, but they've not told any company, to my knowledge, that they've got to do this. I mean, a company has articles of association. They have to prove them out. They become limited companies, right? But then they start making decisions. Once they're okay and they're in business, they start making decisions like, well, we'll work here, we'll put this, and then we'll ship that factory and we'll put it there, with no thought on the sort of social consequences. And the Tory government, and this is what I disagree with, have done nothing to mitigate it. They, after all, are elected by us all to look after us all. And one of the things that they should be doing is saying, okay, these things are going to happen, we can't stop them, but we can sort of put a plan forward that takes care of this. That's my philosophy, right? You've heard enough. I mean, you heard enough. But I'll go on all day.
Yes.
You don't really want
yes.
to.
No, I find it very. So, do you want to tell me what you voted at the last election?
Pardon?
What did you vote at the last election?
I didn't. I couldn't vote for the Labour Party because they're absolute rubbish. They have not. They have not done what they were elected to do, even in opposition. They spent 4 years arguing about who got what job, who should do what, and devil take the hindmost. While this country was being run down, literally run down, right, by a Tory government that had no opposition to face, no piper to pay the tune to. They've let it go. Right? The Tories came in on an unproven theory about monetary restraints and how they were going to do everything, and it's still not proven. And there are very strong voices and very intelligent people in this country who are telling them, look, it's a load of rubbish. They've been branded as wets, right? People look at them and they're not listened to, or they hadn't been listened to in the first parliament of Maggie Thatcher. And this Labour Party did nothing. They aided and abetted Margaret Thatcher by being so bloody stupid. It's unbelievable. So I can go for that. Likewise, the trade unions. They have literally let the people who've elected them to office go to pot. they've not done anything in my mind, and I don't know, they probably have, and probably I'm harsh in my judgment, but to my mind they've done nothing to mitigate what's going on in this country in a concerted way. Well, they've had their little bit, we're not going to talk to Norman Tebbit. That's done no bloody good at all. You know, I mean, but they've organised nothing. They've put no hope into people. All they've done is aided and abetted the Tories, in my opinion, or just let it happen. People have got to the point where they think it's inevitable, and nothing is inevitable in this country. Nothing.
To go back to your own career, when did you leave school? How old were you?
14.
And then straight into a building job?
No. I left home. Sorry, I was at school when I was 14. And I took a job. I can never remember rightly. I think it was 17 or 6 months a week, and I was going to be a training electrician at Ransom Sims and Jeffries, which they make clothes and whatever. And excuse me. Oh, it's okay.
No, I'll just switch to something.
And they said to me, well, what you've got to do also is to run this post bag around to know the works, and which I did. And I said, how long for? And they said, 3 months until the next intake, and then you'll move up. And the next intake came along, and they couldn't or didn't get anybody. And they said, well, look, you'll have to carry on. And I said, no, the agreement was 3 months, and I don't like this post for this job. And they said, well, you know, that's it. And I said, well, I'm not going to do it. The next thing I know, they've got my mother, and by that, my stepfather, and they got them down to the works, and we're all having a good wigging or something like this. I was really concerned, and the man said, no, I said, no. 3 months was the deal, and I've done it diligently, and it's not happened. And I said, when is it going to happen? And if I'm going to have to go, how long? And they said, well, we'll do another 3 months. I said, no, and do it another 3 weeks before you find somebody, because a lot of people will employ somebody.
Yes.
I said, no, I saw that. And my mother was upset.
Yes.
My stepfather, a good old boy, he was upset. So I said, well, you know, they said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. Because that was going to be an apprenticeship.
Yes.
And everything else, right away through. So at the time, they were building a power station down on the river. And my uncle, Pat, said to me, well, you can't be out of work. You come down here, I'll get you a job. So I went down and got me a job, T-boy. So I thought, well, this is good. But doing the T-boy's job, well, I used to pick up quite a lot. You know, I used to pick up overdrive cranes, which the crane guys used to teach me when I went to a professor. And I always found out how to sort of couple up and uncouple the pile drivers. And then I was sort of being by the river all my life. I could scull a boat on my own, and I was starting to get the job sort of sculling the big timbers, the big piling timbers, up and down the river and around this site. And I was thoroughly enjoying it. But there was no future. But I was getting good money. I mean, they were paying me about, I think it was about £4 or £5 a week, which was, you know, from 17 to 6 to 11. So I was able to pay my mother quite a bit of money and enjoy myself. But then I got brown after that because I could see it was going to lead to nowhere. And my other uncle, John, who was in the Navy, he said to me, do you want to, you know, what do you think about the Navy? And I said, oh, I don't want to join the Navy, John. Not the Royal Navy. He said, well, if you don't want to join the Royal Navy, tell yourself off, why don't you sort of have a look at the merchant service? See if you can carve your career. So I went down to Harwich, got myself a ship. Said, Gullyport. I couldn't get away. I went down to Skipper Hall. I forgot all about Skipper Hall. I went down to Ipswich Docks. And Skipper Horlock knew my grandfather. And John had obviously been talking to my grandfather about the problem, and I'd obviously talked to my grandfather about the problem, but not quite in the same way, because it was quite shaker to me when John said to me, "I want you to go down to the Kirk, New Kirk West." I said, and talked to the skipper. So I went down anyway. And the daisy it was. And he wanted a cook. Well, on board the barges, they're sailor barges. They're still up the river. They call them Thames barges, but they're the sailor barges. They've got a mainmast, a foresail, a topsail, and a mizzen. That was it. Flat bottom, carry grain or whatever.
Yeah.
Come on in, Josh.
Shall we leave it there?
Yes, leave it there.
I'll leave this here. So you went to the
RAF. Okay, yeah, I went to, actually, I thought I'd miss it, but there was a compulsory service at the time, and my service in the merchant service didn't count.
Ah, you thought it might?
Well, I just brought
it
in at the time. In fact, I took a shore job at the time with a bloke named Doe, Rowley Doe. He used to clear up dry grass, clear up building sites and stuff like that. I really enjoyed that. It was on my own, I used to do it on my own. I used to say, this is what I want to do, and I used to do it. I had an old tractor, I used to drive around, you know, paddle in the ground, ready for grass seeding, or going out to the fields around, switch, cutting grass, drying it in the dryer, flailing it. It was a good one, I enjoyed that. And then I got this set up. You got a report for service. So I did that. And I clued up at West Kirby, just outside of Liverpool, from training. And I wanted actually wanted to go into the Blue Air Army, but they hadn't got anywhere there. So I then said I'd go into Air Sea Rescue, and they said, yes, you're just a bloke. And they said, we're just a bloke, we'll send you on a firefighting thing. So after I'd been at the firefighting thing for about 2 days, I blew my stack. Well, one thing or another, I told the CO, and I was marched up, that if he wanted me to be a fireman, I'd spend my 18 months in the clink, because I wasn't going to do it. And he said to me, well, all right, you know, after I calmed down, he talked to me, he said, what do you want to do? I said, well, you know, I told you what I wanted to do, and you're too bloody stupid to take any notice of what I'm good at, but I don't want this, so what is this? So he was a nice old guy. He talked to me, and he said, you're best bet, Gary, you can't do that. Be an armourer. He said, but you'll have to join up for 3 years. So I weighed up 18 months of pure misery against 3 years of what I might enjoy, and I just signed on for 3 years, and I did enjoy it, and I came out as an armourer general. With bombs, guns and explosives. I did enjoy that. Well, then I left. Oh, my. Why did he get through?
Oh, boom! Just make sure that's all. So, and then after that, what happened? I mean, I remember you told me all about Scotland last time.
Oh, well, God. After that, what did I do? I decided to... Well, I met a good chap, John Ingram, when I was in the forces. And we decided that we'd take a good hike and clue up in Australia. So we'd walk. Didn't quite pan out the way we decided. we got as far as the south coast of France. And we worked a little bits and pieces, you know. It was late in the season, so the grape picking was finished, and all we ever got was sort of scrubby little jobs, chopping wood once, and... We're mostly in the country. You know, that sort of rubbishy job in the countries we had, you know. Real rubbishy jobs, and they were really sort of funny people, always kind of funny. I don't get on with most people, you know, I mean, I didn't speak much French at the time, but I don't speak much French now. But they were queer people. I think they sort of thought we were a pair of vagrants, to be honest, you know. But anyhow, we clued up And what really capped it, we got to Sansar on the south coast, down below Toulon and Marseille. And we'd walked over the hills, and there'd been a fire on the hills, and we'd walked all night. And I said to them, we want to hit this place, and we'll get a boat from there, right, and we'll get across North Africa. And we arrived in this little place, and there was a little outpost there, the Foreign Legion. But when we walked past, I had to smile because they were blowing them up, and it must have been about 4 or 5 in the morning. I don't know, so it was really early. The sun was just tipping over the hills, and we were as black as the eyes of hell because we'd walked through all this undergrowth that had all been burned up. And got wood. And I said to them, I must have a wash and brush up somewhere. I don't know where. This little place was playing the bugle, and over, and I said to him, you know, if we're not careful, we're going to clue up in this bloody legion, and that's one thing I'm not going to do. And we walked down on the harbour front, and there was a little cafe, and there was a bloke cleaning the windows. And I went up to him, and I said, do you speak English? And he turned around, and he did. And for some unknown reason, it was the first friendly person, you know, really friendly guy. He was a real Gaelic, you know, I said, ah, come in, walked us indoors into this little cafe, and the woman inside come out, and she was his husband. He was her husband. And before you know it, we got a wash and a brush up, and we were drinking, and I wasn't used to, at that stage, we hadn't had a lot to drink. And we got really sold, and we stayed there until all our money had gone. We couldn't get a job, and we didn't get a boat, and it clued up. I went to the embassy, they wouldn't forward me any money. I've got money in England, but they wouldn't forward us any money. And in the end, I said, no, you'll have to go home. So it all ended in a bit of a disaster as far as walking to Australia, but quite enjoyable as far as we were concerned. And we came back to Britain. And that was another story as well.
Yeah.
I came back and thought, well, you know, this is the time I sort of took a job. So, they were advertising training at various centres throughout Britain, you know, for various things. I went down to the Labour Exchange, and they said, well, you know, you just arrived for an agricultural engineer, Derek. And I said, am I? And I said, yes. And they said, we've got a training school at Letchworth. And I went to Letchworth, and I trained and passed as an agricultural engineer. And then they said to me, when I finished, it was about 9 months or something like that. Was it 9 months or 18 months? I forget now. It's a long time ago.
Yes.
And I sort of passed this course. And they said, we want you to go to Sheringham in Norfolk. Well, coming from Suffolk, I never liked Norfolk. And to go to Sheringham, which is right in the heart, you know, it's a dump. So I said, no, I don't particularly want to go there. And I said, oh, well, you've got to go, you know, we've got your job. I said, well, I don't want to go to Sheringham in Norfolk. You know, I mean, that's not my idea of bliss. It's a dump, Norfolk. Anyhow, one thing led to another, and I said, well, in that case, there's nothing we can do for you. So give me my papers, and away I went home. And I then thought, well, I'll take a job. So I took a job at Crane and Bennett's, which is a sort of an engineering firm on the outskirts of Ipswich. And I was a maintenance fitter there, and I had a block of machines to look after, a couple of mates, and I was well away. And I injured my back. Just before I left the training school, I was cleaning for a doctor to earn money. We used to go out and sort of go around, and I got a job building a garage for a doctor, right, and doing his house. And I was up the ladder one day, and the ladder was there, and the eave was sort of poking out, and I hadn't got the ladder on the eave, I got it on the wall. So to look onto the roof, I had to stretch right back.
Yes.
And as I did it, I got this pain on the back. Mm. It was really severe, in the lower lumbar region. And I managed to get down the ladder, and sort of hobbled around, I thought I'd strain the muscle, and I told this doctor. And he said, come on inside, he said, I'll look at you. He had a little surgery then. He laid me on the table, stripped me off, and he said, I think you've sort of done your hip. So he sort of rolled me around a bit and said, you should be better, and I felt downside worse. And this carried on, I don't know, it got better and it got worse. And then I left and I went to Cranes. And then when I was looking after these machines, I had a lot of bending and climbing to do, and the pain came back and it didn't go, and eventually I couldn't bend down, And I got a bit worried, and I thought, well, you know, this is not... So I went to the doctor, and I said, oh, what you got is a slip disc. So, of course, and I, by this time, I'd been to about 3 osteopaths, and they'd all buggered me about and made me feel even worse. But it really got me down, because I couldn't do my job at Crane, so I left. I said, because the bloke said to me, what you doing? I told him. And I said, well, I can't do the job anymore. So they said, well, we'll hold your job open for you. And I said, well, I shouldn't bother if I were you. I mean, I can't very well work, and you can't very well, you know, hold the job open for as long as I think I'm going to be able. Well, so I said, well, I'm not that. And I went, and my Uncle John was in between ships at the time. He was having a bit of a problem. And we used to walk, and I was really reduced to that sort of walk. And in the end, I went to the hospital. I was really worried by this time. And they were giving me all these tablets to kill the pain.
Oh, yes.
And then, yeah, and then I was sort of, they constipated me, so I got tablets for constipation. And in the end, I was really thrown with it. And I saw the doctor, and I said, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, I can hardly walk now. And I would force myself each day. John was a brick. Say to John, I'm going to walk. We'll walk across the heath to Goldfields. And I could literally walk like that. It used to take us hours to walk, perhaps 5 miles. You know. I was frightened if I stopped, I'd stop. Anyhow, Chuck put me in bus. John says to me, get yourself a bus. He said, I'm going down. Because he was not only a surgeon, he was also a master carpenter when he left. He is now a master carpenter. He's back at sea as a chippy. But when he was in the Royal Navy, he was third mate, right, on board destroyers, minesweepers. Oh, I mean, he worked his way up. He cleared up as a third mate now. He'd also got his talents otherwise. So he went down to Bognor Regis, or Lyme Regis, I forget which it was. And I went in hospital for this day. They wrapped me in and said, you'll be here for about 3 or 4 days. And I was out next day, I tried it all for these logs, all these logs around, and I got on the train and went down and joined John. And that's when I travelled around with him as a carpenter. And it was a real laugh at hospital. I didn't know the first thing about carpentry. Right, and that sort of wood, you know. But John is really clever. Every job, and I went, then we went on to 4 or 5 separate sites. I'm trying to think. There was Regis, there was South Brant, there was Altonbury, there was Scotland. 4. And on each job that we went on, he'd say, right, we'll find a different way of doing this. Because when you're on civil construction work, they usually run a very loose bonus system, which means if you can do 5 men's work in a half an hour for a day, you might earn yourself a couple of bob. I mean, they don't give anything.
Yes.
John always could think of a way to do things quicker and did, because he's clever. And so, being akin to my brother, right, no problems. And I used to think, I was clever as well, wasn't I? Well, we moved from... and all the time we got this big plaster cast up. We used to have real fun there, you know. Every time we were on a new site, we used to kid the blokes. John used to get his big mallet out and hit me his arm, fed up with you, bonk, you know. The blokes used to look around and say, do that again, John, I'll get really upset, you know, with the mallet. Of course, they soon proved it for something like that. But, fair some fun. But when we went to South Brant, it was a sort of loosely organised place. And John, we were instrumental, well, he was, I'm not. Designing a new way to put together these crates that they called the concrete, and they were big steel things, and they had a way of putting it together, I can't remember, but he did it quicker and better, and our bonus went up from about 15 bob a week to something like £2.10 a week. Then it was pension and fence. It was great. Well, the site engineer was really taken, and he was particularly taken with John and myself, and the site foreman was a proper little Burke. You know, he really was. He was a chippy, and he didn't really know his business. No, I mean, I didn't know as much as he did, but I mean, I've seen him on the side of the lot. And he was forever lasting, making sort of wrong decisions. They weren't important decisions. I mean, he was only side for me, but they were wrong decisions, and the men didn't like it. And we were lodged in this hotel, John and I, in
exactly. One night all the chickens came and I said, look, John, we get together. We want the union involved on this sort of thing not going on. And I said, there's too many chances come on here without union cards, you said. Well, I hadn't got a union card. John had, but I had. I wasn't member of the union, but not. So I sat and I thought, God, this is going to be awkward, you know. And so we all sat down and they were really going on, you know, and we were buying pints, and there were about 20 to 25 chippies on the job, cartons. Yeah, one thing led to another, and I said to me, look, Derek, we think we'd like you to be the shop steward. So I said, would you? I said, yes. I said, well, you know, that's a great honour. I said, you know, to sort of represent you, but I don't know whether I really can. You know, I said, I don't know anybody in this part of the country. They said, no, but you know what's right, you know what's wrong, you know what we want. And I said, okay. So I said, well, the first thing, they said, and we want a card show. I said, yes, the first thing we do is a card show. Well, as I was shop steward, I didn't show my card. I got everybody, and we got organised, and I got to organise that. And I said to John after some time, this is really not on, you know, I mean, I'm going on here, and I've got no card, and I'm even dealing with the union official going in Southampton, who hadn't got the wit to ask me for my card when I was going in with all these cards and taking money. All he wanted to do was boom and play darts. And the job cleared up where this foreman got the bullet. And
was it UCAT? Or was it union also?
As the war, I think.
Oh, ASTO. Yes.
I think it was ASTO. I guess a long time back, but it was Carpenter's Union. I think it was ASTO. Anyhow, it was the Carpenter's Union.
Yes, Woodcutting.
I never joined it, so I mean, I don't know what to say about it. But just prior to leaving the job, and what brought about the offer, we were building a great bridge across, they dug a great dam, a big hole for this dam to go, right? And the concrete blocks we were shuttering and making up were to put in the bottom as a base, or whatever they were going to do, or whatever it was. And they'd drive in piles, and they used to blow this thing with a really big glass of dynamite. That's really exciting. But over this bridge, they wanted to finish before Christmas. And the site engineer came, John, went sick. Now, John says to me, Derek, there's only one way to get that bay in bridge across there. And he explained to me in detail, and I wanted to do it. I said, okay. And it did involve quite a dangerous sort of situation where we were walking on the steel girders with these great big lumps of timber, and I mean great lengths of timber, sort of 20, 30 foot long, and sort of half a foot square, to about five or six blokes to manhandle, and to take the lead across the thing. But John said, this is the way we'll do it. Then he went down with the bad blue or cold, whatever it was, and left me, because the engineer came to me and said, you know, can you do it? I said, yes, so long as you give me John's bonus, and you pay him his bonus with his sick, I'll do it. So he agreed. So I got the others together, and they agreed, and we went and we put this bridge up for him, and it was a dangerous work, and it was hard work, and it was freezing cold, and how any of us weren't killed on that, I'll never know. But we weren't, and we did it. And I got the bonus of John, I got the bonus of me. Now he sacked the unit, the engineer, and he deserved the sack. But then he did something silly. He offers John the foreman's job, and he wanted me to be a sort of leading light with John. In other words, he wanted me to sort of work with John. And I said to John, oh, I can't do that. You know, that's stretching it a bit beyond the limits. I don't know what to talk about. There's better men on this side. You know, they've got kids, they live locally, and this is rubbish. So I said, I know what you're going to do, but I'm leaving. So John said, okay, you'll go, and I'm going. So we both went. We went to Ireland, then we went to Scotland. We had some real fun. Real fun, you know, I mean, I explained that to you last week.
Yeah,
excellent.
And
all this time, for 18 odd months and more, or part of that time, I'd done this bloody cast off. Eventually went back to the church, and the doctor said to me, I'll take it off for you. And by that time, it was... When it came off, I must have stunk like a polecat. I didn't realise it. But it cured it, and I used to have to wear a little brace afterwards around the stomach, which I threw away and exercised, and now I'm, you know, I sometimes get a twinge down the back of my leg, but nothing, you know, to cure it. But the upshot of that was that, again, I was sort of at a loose end when we came back from Scotland.
Yes.
I was at a loose end, and my Uncle Pat said to me, hey, Gary, he said, why don't you say, come with me? He said, I want to go back, but I'll get you a job. I said, what's that? He said, welding. I said, well, I can't weld. I've never welded before, Christ's sake. And I don't like industry anyhow. I don't.
Yeah.
No, he said, you'll soon get used to this. So I went down to Tipton, and he got the job. And I travelled up to Tipton, and I thought I'd enjoyed it. And I booed up as an A-welder. You know, soon have been an A-welder. Well, I booed up very rapidly as an A-welder.
So how did you pick up the trade?
I was taught. They had a training school.
Oh, a training school.
Oh, yes, I went to training school, and they taught us everything there was to know about welding. Pressure welding, pipe welding, overhead, vertical, incline, the lot, right? There was nothing I didn't know about welding when I came out of that school. And I used to have to go back to the school once every 6 months when I was a C welder, once every 4 months when I was a B welder, and once every 3 months once I became an A welder to do test pieces. Because you used to go out on site, right? And you used to have to weld up all these high sort of the high-pressure steam pipes, you know, where they superheat the steam. Well, I mean, you've got to know what you're doing. You've got to weld them up properly. You have to sort of heat them up, wrap them, heat them up, bring them up, and then cool them down gradually. Then they x-ray them. You know, you have somebody come on site and they x-ray them. Well, if you make a balls up of it, no, you could be 12 more hours doing a pipe, and a lot of money involved. It could be 3 months and you're an A-welder. But A-welders could also take charge of sites, which I did on a couple of occasions. Well, I met my wife while I was doing that. I used to have to sign contracts, you know, 2-year contracts, 1-year contracts. And I wanted to break the contract, I spoke to the engineer, and I wrote to the head office. I didn't want to travel anymore, you know, I'm in a plan.
How many years later is that?
A
couple of years?
No, I'm talking. The time span I've been talking about now, because I married Pat in 1959.
Yes.
Okay. So these things happened
beforehand.
Between about 1956 and about 1946-7 to 1957, somewhere around that period, the things I've been talking about.
Yes, yes.
You know, it sounds a lot, but I mean, 3 months you can do a whole lot of things like that. Where I flew. And then I took a job down in the Black Country there. That was the first time I'd ever had anything to do with the Black Country. And I mean, it was an incandescent heat down in Smellick. And I took lodgings down there as well. Now, a nice people in the lodgings, but the job was a real laugh. I mean, it was filthy, and it was brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, they all worked in little clans, they all worked for us, and they worked for practically nothing. I was working for about £12 a week at that time, in that place. And they had a bonus scheme going, which would add sometimes as much as 30 bob, £1.50.
Yes, yes.
And I was working along, doing my bit. I sort of didn't mix very well with the Black Country guys. I mixed with two or three, but not with a lot of them, you know. I mean, I had friends, you know, I used to sit and have a laugh and a joke. But there was a clique. And I happened to say to our Sill one day, can I have a look at your waistlet? So he said, yes. When I looked at his waistlet, my waistlet, they were about the same. I said, that's all right. He said, he's a funny old. He said, you're looking to see if there's any difference, ain't you? I said, yeah. He said, no, we're looking at mine. He said, I work the same time as you. I said, yeah. He said, yes. I said, yeah. I said, it's this Saturday and Sunday. Work. And I said, and he was a Salvation Army. And he said, I won't come in Saturday, Sunday. He said, I'm away doing my thing. He said, who you want to look at? And I'll forget the name of the bloke. He was a great, big, bruisey type bloke. And what I didn't like about him, he never washed, he used to have egg and stuff, and I always remember this egg down his tie. So, and he was the leading light. So I went across to him, and I said, I don't want to sort of intrude, you know. I said, could I have it mind your own fucking business, you know? So I said, oh, all right. I said, you know, can't make it, mind your own ethnic business, you know. So I went to the forum. I said to him, I'd like to know the split of this bonus.
Oh, he said, that's none of your business. I said, hang on a minute, it is my business. I said, I work here, and now I'm contributing to that tonnage out of the gate, and I want to know about it. But I don't think I'm getting the deal, so no, the things I'm getting drifting across the shop to me. And yeah, next thing I know, this bloke, like, got advice, come over, and he was sort of doing all the money, what he wasn't going to do, what he wasn't going to do. And I really got a bit upset, and I sat up on his arse. And I went to this foreman again. The foreman came screaming at me, you're sacked, you're sacked. I said, yes, well, if I'm sacked, now I want to know about the bonus. He would tell me, so I went to the finance office. And I got the police, because I went to the finance office. I wasn't wrong, I just said, I want to know.
Yes.
But it's bonus. Yeah. Next thing I said, policeman, I said, what do you want? He said, what? He said, they said, you've come into the finance office. I said to the guy, I'm upset you, of course. He said, no. I said, what are you doing then? He said, well, the foreman's on there. I said, has he? I said, yeah. I said, okay. I said, where's the manager's office? He said, well, come with me to the manager's office. So I threw it up in the manager's office. And he wasn't a bad guy at all, but he didn't know what was going on in the shop. So I said to him, I've been sacked. And he said, what are you sacked for? I said, because I just dumped this bloke on his ass. I said, because he's less than nice. I said, but I'm worried about my money, not about him, not about your foreman, I've been sacked. So now I said, you've got to make my wages up. I said, would you make my wages up quickly and let me know? I said, I do intend to know. I said, because if you don't tell me, I shall go somewhere and force you to bloody tell me, one way or another. He said, hang on. He said, I'll tell you. He said, you should know. And the upshot of all that was that they'd been paying. People were coming on Saturday and Sunday, and this is the thing I didn't tweak. And they were sweeping up. But when they were sweeping up, they were also getting the hour's bonus. So if we'd earned in 5 days, shall we say, £100 bonus on tonnage, I had 44 hours, I think it was, or 40, whatever it was, hours of that bonus at the time. But if they came in sweeping up, they got more. So the bonus I got was reduced, and theirs was expanded by the hours they worked, but they weren't earning it in those time. And the whole upshot was, I was offered my job back, which I couldn't, you know, I said no. But they paid me all the money that they owed me. And what they did down there afterwards, I had no idea, because I wasn't interested. But to get that job, I had to join the trade union, which I hadn't been a member of before. It was Boilermakers. And I got the job, then I went down to see Harold Pitt, who was, I told you last week, he was less than useless. And I got a job at Coventry. And then I think I filled you in last week on my sort of...
Yes.
My business from Coventry down in.
Yes. Was that a closed shop? That was a closed shop, wasn't
it? Yes, it was a closed shop in respect to welding, and they allowed Boilermakers and sheet metal workers in there.
Yes. Alright, yes, they had some. What at the time did Claylane do for, what sort of welding did they do there, which they didn't do at Solly Hall? Do you remember?
Yeah, well, they didn't do any at Solly Hall at the time. Sorry, that's a lie.
Was it later?
They built the chassis at Solly Hall. Those chassis that are built here now, they built at Solly Hall. Okay? And we built all the cross members and the outriggers for the chassis. And we built the roofs, which was Argonaut. We built the roofs, all the roofs, all the side screens, all the wind screens, and we built and the roofs. We built all those things there. And really, it was, and I enjoyed working there. You know, they were nice people. And I gave you my story last week.
What I was wondering, you didn't tell me how you became a steward at Claylane, and for which group and so on.
Well, that was simple, really. The steward, Jock Sharp, I think his name was, left.
Right.
And I think there was a general sort of... There was a general sort of unease in the shop about bonus earnings and what have you. And two or three blokes approached me and said, would I sort of be the shop steward? Nobody really wanted the job, that's the truth of the matter. It wasn't that I was a legion like, it was that none of them really wanted the job. And I sort of said yes, so long as we, you know, so long as it's all above board and it's voted and done. So we called a shop meeting and I was proposed and the men voted on it and I became shop steward.
which was a normal state of affairs.
Around 1960, very soon after you came.
Well, it was about 19. Yeah, I married in 1959, and I was about 1959, 1960. Yeah, that's it. 1959.
So it shows you how weak the shop steward organisation really was, as you more or less walked in. And
it was weak, but it was terribly powerful. It was powerful in the fact that about that time, the management's, I don't know, perhaps it's when I became aware.
Yeah.
Right. I wasn't really, my mind had never been tuned to industry.
Mm.
Working in a factory was sort of new to me.
Mm.
Working in sort of close confines with a lot of people was new to me. I'd always worked much on my own, much with a few people. I'm building sites, you're talking to perhaps one or two people, you're not talking to a lot. 10 is a big number. There was something like 30 or 40 of us in a very close confine, and another 30 or 40 up the top shop.
Yes.
And
how did you, sorry to interrupt, but how did you get a job at Rover in the first place?
I took a trade test at the Rover company.
But I mean, why Rover? Did the union send you there?
Yes. The trade, they said, you know, there's a job. It's a two or three little jobs around. And I wasn't very impressed, but they said there's one at the Rover. And I liked the look of it when I got to Coventry. I mean, it was nice, you know, it was smaller than some of the places I'd been to. I mean, some of the places are certainly here in the Black Country. You know, a lot of great prisons, really.
Mm.
You know, in the Black Country, these buildings that they put up as factories, although I'm alarmed at the rate of destruction of our industry today, can only applaud the fact that they've knocked up bloody things down. I mean, to send people in them to work, never been right in my mind, but still, that's a personal thing. But, so yes, I like the look of it. It was nice, you know, the sooner they walked in, it was cosy, and there didn't seem to be too many people, you know. I mean, and those people that I met were quite friendly. I mean, they were a friendly bunch of people.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
The manager over there, his name now, but he was a nice fellow. He was a big fellow, but he was a nice fellow, you know, and you could sort of believe what he said, you know, and sort of didn't mind doing what he said, you know, he was that sort of person. Anyhow, yeah, so that's how I got the job. I took a trade test and I was in. That was it, really.
And what did it mean, being a steward at the time? What did you do?
Quite a lot, really. A lot of it was in shop, you know. I mean, we had, when I sort of took the job on, there were, and the reason I found I got the job up was there was a lot of jealousies inside the working group. People had good jobs and people had bad jobs. So if a person was, if there was a job that you got to work like an absolute maniac on, right, to earn your money, somebody else would have a job to finish at dinner time. So when I got a good look at this, called shop meet, that was one of the first things I did. Called a shop meeting and I said, you know, there's enough of us here to eat this job, and it's not really right that some of us have got easier jobs than others. Shop stewards, always, the men always chipped in. I think it was 26 shillings worth of work a week for the shop steward. So I said, I'm quite willing to forego my 26 shillings a week, right? But on the back of the proposition that we all have a turn at the best jobs. So what we're going to do, what I propose that we do, is that every week or every fortnight or every month, depending on what we agree, we all shift some of these jobs around. Because you perhaps have four jobs a week, people who are on the number twos had one job a week, and it was a bastard of a job. The number threes was a job that people didn't like too much, and so on. And anyhow, those people, which were the majority of people, the other people had got a good job.
Yes.
Anyway, it was agreed. And when we did it, and we got used to the system, and we enforced the system, and by the very fact that we all agreed to it, we started to finish quite early. We could finish sometimes on a Thursday. Our weeks were there. There was another way. And so the company, I think, as I don't know, decided to send more in. We got more work and took our time up, and we divided the other work and so on. So that was one of the sort. The other one was to sort of keep a general order and stuff. You'd be surprised at sort of the victimisation that goes on in the shop sometimes, you know.
I found it when I was in the Navy, you know, I mean, there's always somebody who's the butt in any group of people when there is no real close discipline. And if that person can have a hell of a life. So one of the jobs was to sort that situation out. There was a coloured fellow there, and there were two or three, as it happens, Irish people there, and what they used to really go on at them, and I stopped it one day. They walked around, they came to a head one day, and they walked around with a bloody a gibbet with a sort of replica of this coloured fellow. And that really upset me. Not that it was coloured, but because they were doing what they were doing.
Yeah.
Really not right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mum.
So I
asked this analyst who was a leader, and I said, what do you really think you're on? Without going into details. On a personal basis, I was trying to throw it. But on a shop base, I called a shop mate and I said, you know, this is the sort of thing that's going on. I'm no longer representing. You know, I don't want to represent this sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I would avoid never. I'd seen the sort of thing going on. I mean, I left home when I was 14 and a half. And I'd seen it all, you know, going on this way. But it surprised me in such a... I think I was shaken because I was such a nice bunch of blokes. Accurately. They can be like that. I mean, whatever it was, I don't know what it was, but that really upset me. And it really upset me. Perhaps it was a personal thing and not a general thing. I don't know.
Yeah,
I called it and I stopped it. There was that sort of thing. We used to regulate them. And then there were the sort of dealings with management, where we elected, for instance, a pool leader. The pool leader would clock everything that we'd done, and then he would take the sheet in to the foreman, right, or the manager, the foreman as well.
Yes.
So that's what we've done, that's what we've been paying for. So we worked and we used to regulate our work. When it came to intakes of labour, right, company come down and say, we want you to take five blokes in because we're going to put some work in. We would sit down and say, no, we would like three men in and we will earn the other. So we'll put our wages up and we want to get to this musical 20 quid, like, you know what I mean? So there was that sort of trading. Very little to do with the union proper. We had a branch, and I became president of the branch. Basically, because nobody else wanted to be president. And I was keen, I mean, in my own way, I was keen. I thought there were things that could be done. But I was keen, and the treasurer was keen, and the secretary was keen.
Yes, and that was it.
Was to call meetings and try to get... I asked Harold Bibb to come down on about 10 occasions, and he wouldn't come. That was the very end. And when I did get men there, you know, there would be about 4 or 5 of them at the meeting. You know, sometimes we were lucky and got 10.
Mm. Mm.
And so the organisation was very weak. And because that organisation was weak, the liaison between the union officials and the shop stewards was practically non-existent.
Right.
Now, thereby came the strength of the trade union on the shop floor. Because there was no real restraint or guidance from the central trade union on how we should conduct ourselves, if the manager came in and said something we didn't like, and we say it was, I mean, not that we didn't like, I mean, not in that sense, but you say a work practice,
wanted a work practice change,
and we decided that we didn't want to,
yes,
then we would take action first.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do it. And the one thing they said, okay, well, we'll sit down for a while. We're not going to do it. No. And then, after day, if it wasn't settled, we used to go out to the union office. So, by the way, you know, we got a downer going on there. 2 o'clock yesterday, we stopped. Well, I'm telling you, what should we do about it? What are they saying? You know? Well, they're saying we've got to do so. What do you advise us to do? Well, stick it out for a while and see what happens.
Yeah.
Are you going to put... No, we can't make it official. No. Are you coming down? No, we're busy. I've got to go to so-and-so. Right, ring us back. We'll come down and see us tomorrow. Now, that was the sort of... And that wasn't just the boilermakers. That was rampant in the
TNG.
It was rampant in the sheet metal workers.
it was rampant. The shop floor had stewards with the collective power that rivaled the management's, if you like, well, it rivaled their administrative power and it rivaled their sort of resolve.
But wasn't that also because they didn't have much to do with what happened on the shop floor? I mean, the example where you say we decided that, you know, we had a sort of job sharing or job changing. Because, yeah, they left it all to the workers, basically.
Well,
basically,
it was
different from the building site, in a way.
Well, the difference on a building site to that was so vast that it would take me a book to tell you about. But I mean, perhaps I've oversimplified that, perhaps I should detail it. We would get a list each week of what we had to do
before.
Then we'd split it up.
Yeah, that's what
we'd
pick
up, like, and we'd send it back to them and tell them that's what we want paid for, right? Now, management had its study services, had inspectors, it had time study engineers, and all these people. So they were all doing their job, but we used to control the place. I mean, if we said somebody wasn't coming in, they didn't come in. I mean, much the same today. The trade unions today, even with all that's gone under the bridge, and saying, trade union status person's not coming in, there's usually one big huff, unless the company's willing to sort of go head on and charge directly against the union's wishes. Right?
Mm.
It's very much the same today.
Mm.
I'm not saying it's the same in the car industry today, but, or at least our particular industry, but there is a shade of it. There's still a shade of it. So this, the shop floor stewards, although they were not important people in the trade unions, I mean, the trade union officials really at that time weren't so interested in the car industry. Howard Bibb was more interested in the heavy industry.
Yes, no, that's the point of it.
Mr. Cooper, who was a sheet metal worker, was very interested in the car industry, right? Because they'd got it tied up tight, like the bloody mafia. Right? They used to move men from one job to another job. There's a job going to so-and-so. They told the convener, that man will be coming for a job. Now, whatever, the company in the end just used to go to the trade union, can you send some blokes on? And they'd send who they wanted into these jobs. And that's a fact.
Yeah.
They'd